It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A groundbreaking ceremony was held Monday to kick off construction for the $1.8 billion bridge that will replace the aging Blotnick Bridge. It connects Superior to Duluth, Minnesota, and it first opened in 1961.
Wisconsin and Minnesota transportation leaders were on hand, along with Governor Tony Evers, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, and members of Congress, including Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, who told the crowd,
"This bridge is more than an investment in concrete and steel. We are investing in our people, in the workers who will build it, the businesses that depend on it, and the families who will use it every day. This bridge is a down payment on the future of our economy and our communities."
Planning and preliminary construction work on the Blotnick Bridge replacement has been underway for 6 years. It'll take another 5 years to build it.
The estimated 33,000 vehicles that travel on that bridge every day will be rerouted 5 miles southwest over the Bong Bridge.
To discuss the economic impacts of the bridge construction, we're joined by Janice Meyer, Assistant Executive Director at the Development Association in Superior. Janice, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you and good morning.
Hi, and for a look at how the surrounding community will be impacted by the bridge replacement, we're joined by Mayor of Superior, Jim Payne. Mayor Payne, welcome back.
Good morning.
Mayor Payne, let's start with you. What is coming to the Twin Ports with this project? What will be some of the features of the new Blotnick Bridge?
Well, to be honest, I'm not thinking that far ahead. It's exciting, you know, what's going to appear in our community in the 2030s, but that's very far ahead. I mean, it's going to be a really effective new bridge. It's going to be an improved bridge, particularly since it will have a non-motorized path connecting our communities for the first time ever. I mean, there's one now, but it's so far out of the way as to make it non-functional. But our focus right now is getting through the next year, not the next 5 years. That is so far in the future. We have a lot to figure out right now.
A lot to figure out right now. So what does the timeline look like for this bridge replacement? What are the steps in this project?
So I was joking yesterday at the groundbreaking that for all of the lawmakers that spoke, that was effectively a ribbon cutting for them. Their work is done. Our work is just getting started. And so, in fact, three of the folks that spoke won't be in office when this bridge closes. And that happens early next spring. That bridge will close and 30,000 vehicles will be rerouted. And I noticed in the intro, you said 5 miles south.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the Minnesota side.
Ah, okay.
In the Wisconsin side, it's only about a mile south. And that means cramming 30,000 extra vehicles into a bottleneck that right now struggles to hold the existing 20 or 25,000 vehicles that are already using the Bong Bridge.
Governor Evers and Governor Walz of Minnesota, they were joking about, well, they won't have to deal with the complaints. Complaints could be more traffic and more headache, more congestion is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, there are going to be a lot of very real challenges from this. And to be honest, the traffic, being stuck in traffic, I'm not as worried about that. I mean, that's just you sit in your car. You can listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. You'll be fine. The real impact, there are impacts to cost and economy. If you spend an extra half hour to 45 minutes in your car, that's burning fuel that you weren't burning before. And as you mentioned also at the top of the hour, fuel is very expensive right now, and it's likely to continue to get worse. And so those are just real expenses people are going to pay that impacts our air quality, that many cars idling. And that's just less productive time for folks that they could be at work, they could be with their families, they could be enjoying the city of Superior, and they're going to be in their car. But again, hopefully enjoying WPR.
Janice, turning to you, how might businesses in Superior be affected by the closure of the Blotnick Bridge, you know, as construction gets underway?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we've been conducting is starting an economic impact study. About 3 years ago, Jim Caesar, our executive director, said, okay, we need this bridge. Everybody's in agreement on this. But how will this impact business? And what are those potential implications? And so from the surveys that we've sent out, specifically from business owners and operators, they are really worried about a loss in revenue, and their customer base is going to decline. Specifically, as Mayor Payne mentioned, to those congestion, those detours, the longer travel times, and mostly are concerned that they're going to start selecting Minnesota-based alternatives during the closure. We are an interconnected twin port. That was especially clear yesterday, and in how important this bridge is to our area. And a large amount, the 126 business owners and operators that responded to our survey, a large amount of their revenue and customers currently come from Minnesota. And so there is a number of concerns that we found, especially with our small business owners and those in retail, entertainment, the dining experience and construction, that are not completely confident that without additional support, they're going to be able to withstand the closure.
I think you also learned that 30 smaller businesses said they might close. What can be done to reduce the amount of losses here from this construction?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we have started is called the Bridge to Progress program, and that has four pillars that we have found and businesses have prioritized that they need. They need help preserving financial stability. We are working to understand what's happening, but we don't know. So a PPP program, some forgivable loans and grants. We have asked the state legislature through their state budget process, the last one, as well as have put this forward as a Superior Days issue. We are continuing to work to find funding to support businesses in that way. A few others prepare with training and assistance. We are actually kicking off here at the Development Association a small business training series with generous support of WEDC. So that's really going to be able to help those small businesses be able to connect, pivot, and prepare before and during the bridge closure. So we're hopeful for that. And then we're continuing to look for funding in areas like promotion and tourist spending. Consumers in our consumer survey, they've talked about that they're going to consolidate trips and they're going to shift spending closer to home. And so how can we capitalize on this and make this an opportunity for Superior, Douglas County, Northern Wisconsin to get individuals to spend their money more often on this side of the bridge? We do have a congressionally directed funding request in with Senator Baldwin's office right now. So we're hopeful for that, as well as some local commitments that may be coming through from the city and the Tourism and Development Commission.
That is Janice Meyer with us, Assistant Executive Director at the Development Association in Superior. Mayor of Superior, Jim Payne, is here. We're talking with him how Superior's community and economy will be impacted by the closure of the Blatnik Bridge while a new one is constructed. Mayor Payne, Wisconsin, Minnesota, federal government, all contributing to this $1.8 billion price tag. Can you explain how this bridge will be paid for and then how much money Wisconsin is putting into it?
This is primarily a federal project. You know, a bridge of this scale can't be built without federal money. So the federal grant is the vast majority of the cost. It's over $1 billion. Wisconsin and Minnesota both share a lot of the planning load, but and I can't speak to the actual full amount that has come from the state of Wisconsin, but it's on par with what Minnesota has spent, even though Minnesota is the lead agency. So we have two bridges in Duluth Superior. MnDOT is responsible for the Blatnik Bridge and WisDOT is responsible for the Bong Bridge. So MnDOT does get to be the lead here, but we've been equal partners largely in the expenses, and they've been very gracious and equal partners in the planning as well.
In a press release about the groundbreaking, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy celebrated the Trump administration releasing the funds for this project. He also said, quote, before awarding these dollars, the department did the work to guarantee taxpayer funds would not support DEI-based contracts during construction, end quote. Did state or local officials have to make concessions to the Trump administration to secure funding here?
No, of course not. I would have never conceded to something like that. That, in fact, you saying that right now is the first I've heard of it. It's, in fact, this administration was actually pretty frustrating to deal with in releasing the funds. They did delay the release of those funds. I went to Washington to try and meet with as many people as I possibly could, including Secretary Duffy's office. Keep in mind, that is my former congressman. And to try and get some explanation for why the funds were being held up. I remember Senator Baldwin's office was equally frustrated, but they were instrumental in helping to put the pressure on the administration that this is not a partisan bridge. This is a bridge that serves absolutely everybody in two states, including a very large number of people that voted for this administration. And so in the end, I think they caved to the pressure of their own supporters and actually lived up to the commitment of the United States to fund this bridge, which is critical to the transportation needs of the United States.
Janice, I know we're going to look ahead here to this October of 2031 or thereabouts when this Blatnik Bridge opens, the new one, 4-lane. It's got a pedestrian and bike path on the side of it. It's got scenic overlooks. What impact could it have on Superior's economy?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is just that sense of community pride for people to be able to go up, get selfies on the bridge, to be able to have another way to access each other's communities, I think is going to be huge for those that are our neighbors, our friends, and our family that live here locally. But I think from a tourism standpoint, that this could be a really great draw. And we may see some businesses that are really going to support perhaps bikes or different ideas that could come from this as well.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. That is Jim Payne, Mayor of Superior, and Janice Meyer, Assistant Executive Director at the Development Association in Superior. They joined us to talk about how Superior's community and its economy will be impacted by the closure of the Blatnik Bridge while a new one is constructed. Demolition of that old bridge is set to begin in March, and the $1.8 billion replacement officially got underway yesterday with a groundbreaking ceremony.
Coming up, the Trump administration says it will cut tariffs on certain ground beef products in an attempt to lower consumer costs. The head of a Wisconsin farmers group says there won't be a lot of benefit and it could hurt agriculture here in the state.
And it isn't long-term stability for the consumer, and it's certainly short-term pain for our farmers across the state.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump recently signed a proclamation allowing 300,000 tons of beef to be imported into the U.S. under a lower tariff rate in an effort to reduce prices.
President Trump announced the plan on Truth Social last month. This comes as the price of ground beef rose to a near record $6.89 a pound in July. That's according to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis.
Farm groups and Republican politicians have pushed back on the proposal. The National Cattlemen's Beef Association called the move undercutting American farmers. Both Wisconsin candidates for governor also spoke against the proposal.
For more, Brad Olson is with us, president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau. Brad, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, your organization has criticized that announcement from the Trump administration, saying they were going to move to import a lot of beef, ground beef products, and sell them below current market value. What are your concerns?
Well, just short-term, you know, market manipulation. I mean, this is not a long-term thing. And by saying that, you know, it's going to be sold at a significantly lower price in the stores, certainly hurts our farmers across Wisconsin with that kind of short-term move. And it isn't long-term stability for the consumer. And it's certainly short-term pain for our farmers across the state.
What are you hearing from the members of your organization who have cattle, who have beef cattle? What kind of things are they telling you?
Well, I think the difference for Wisconsin somewhat is we have a lot of dairy cattle being bred to beef bulls. And so it isn't just a beef thing in Wisconsin. It's also affecting the dairy herds significantly as well. So just concerned about the drop in beef prices, the drop in bull calf replacements, those kinds of things. And when we're on quite a stretch of downturn of all of agriculture markets here, this is beef has been the one bright spot in agriculture over the last few months.
Right, those prices are actually helping farmers break even or actually make a profit?
Oh, 100%. When you look at the dairy side of things, those sales of those calves are a lot of times on a lot of farms the extent of the profit for the year.
There are concerns from consumers about the price of beef these days. They might say, well, you know, I could use a short-term little bit, anyway, of price relief. What do you say to consumers about the longer view that you and farmers are taking?
Well, I think, you know, short-term is good. I mean, we would, all of us as consumers would like to see the prices go down some. But I think you could look at that across all sectors of our industry or of every industry and say the consumer would like the prices to go down. And at the end of the day, the prices are up on the farm, but they're up considerably more in the grocery store than they are on the farm. And so, as I said earlier, this is... This is the one and really only bright spot in agriculture now, and I would say that as we continue to lose more farms, it has been said by multiple Secretary of Agriculture's across both party lines that food security is national security, and we're getting to the point where we have to understand that the low number of farmers being right around 1.5% of the population in the nation, that is a real possibility that a nation that cannot feed itself is truly not secure. And we see this year that, beef imports are up considerably as it is. And it isn't necessarily about this. There's always been beef ported into the United States. So that's not anything new. It becomes the volume that's imported.
You've called on the president to work with the U.S. agriculture sector to strengthen beef supply domestically. What kind of policies would you like to see?
Just policies that keep our members and farmers, not just across Wisconsin, but across the nation in business. I think there's ways we can work. I mean, there's no secret. Over the last few years, we've just had some weather-related issues. Again, not necessarily in Wisconsin, but across the nation in beef-producing areas that have lowered the beef herd to what it is today. It's lowest in almost 75 years. And work together to create a plan. We are slowly building that herd back. Beef, unlike dairy, unlike other livestock industries, cannot be built on a short-term basis. We're getting, one replacement a year out of every female animal. So it takes a long time to rebuild that, and it is going to be. It took quite a while to get here. It's going to take some while to get back, but. Making sure that we're supporting the American beef farmers in these and getting that beef herd built back is important. And sitting down with members of the administration to get a plan that works, not in the short term, but in the long term, is what we're asking the administration for.
Expanding the beef herd, as you just said, it isn't fast, and as I understand, it isn't cheap either. What are you hearing from your members about some of the uncertainty around, are these tariffs, this tariff cut going to only be around for 90 days? What is next year going to look like? Is some of the uncertainty making people a little hesitant to take the plunge into expanding?
Some of that, yes, I would agree, because on the on the farm side, that uncertainty over, 60 to 90 days. Again, we're in this in the agriculture business. We're in this for the long term, not in 60 to 90 days. For us, nothing is, we're still going to be having calves, selling beef over that course, and it just kind of stays the same. So market interruptions like this that are short are not necessarily good for the industry.
And finally, since I've got you on the line, I wanted to get your take on the wider trade back and forth between the Trump administration and Canada, not just beef now, but in general with Wisconsin agriculture. What do you have your eye on? What are some of your biggest fears or maybe hopes of what comes out of all this?
Well, I guess the concerns is that it keeps going on. The disagreement on trade. The hopes is that at the end of the day, we come out that with something that is, fair for both countries, fair for dairy, fair for beef in Wisconsin, that an agreement gets made that's workable, not just for our state, but both countries in this, and moves agriculture forward and puts us in a better place.
Brad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brad Olson is the president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau. For Analysis Now, Brenda Botel is with us. She's professor, statewide extension specialist, and department chair of agricultural economics at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. Brenda, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we dive into this tariff and imported beef situation, what is it that's been driving up the price of beef in the United States lately?
Well, we just have a very short supply of beef right now. We've had several years where we've been decreasing the herd size, and coupling that then with the screw room issue. So we were having less cattle that we were able to import. All of that basically brings that we have less cattle means less beef.
Okay, maybe a dumb question. I know with dairy cows, a cow today produces way more milk, right, than a cow 20 years ago, say, because of genetics and nutrition and things like that. Is there anything comparable? Are we, maybe we have fewer beef cattle, but they're bigger and we get more meat per unit?
Oh, we definitely do. Yes, most definitely. If you were comparing, say, for example, the amount of beef that we get from an animal today relative to one from even 20 years ago or 40 years ago, we get way more beef. So we will never need to be at the same size cattle herd as we were, say in the 70s or the 90s. However, we still, even given that and given the desire by the U.S. consumer for U.S. beef, we have a strong demand for it. We just don't have enough animals still to meet that.
Okay, that brings in this idea from President Trump cutting tariffs on X amount of beef, ground beef in particular, as I understand it from other countries. Do you see that potentially having an impact, potentially bringing down the price that consumers are paying?
Well, Trump's proclamation or Trump's agreement basically stated that, in order to be able to, the way I understood it is that with no out of quota tariff for those days, they had to agree to sell it for 25% below the market price. Now, we don't know where the beef's coming from or anything like that, or what that agreement is. So that particular beef will be lower. The thing is, though, just because that particular beef is lower doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. consumer is going to be paying 25% less, because that beef that we're bringing in is that lean beef trims. And we're going to basically, that's going to be frozen beef that we're going to have to unfreeze. Then we're going to have to basically dilute it with current U.S. So maybe some fattier domestic beef, things like that. And then basically freeze it again. And it'll probably go to maybe school lunch programs or universities or fast food stores. That's typically the location where that type of beef would go. So that might be lower, but if it just because a portion of it's 25% lower doesn't mean that the entirety that when it gets to the consumer is going to be 25% lower.
Okay, so with that qualification, ground beef might be slightly cheaper by the time somebody's paying for it. And we're just talking ground beef here, right? There's not, you know, the cuts of beef we might see at the butcher stand.
Right. This is just ground beef that they're saying. And so, and yes, I do. It will. It should bring down ground beef prices for the next 3 months. It won't be that 25%. And it might bring down some of those whole muscle cuts. The issue becomes in that, one, how much are the retailers going to actually be able to decrease it, you know, like at the grocery store so that the consumer can get there. But then the issue becomes too, even just a long term, you know, as we decrease these prices by bringing in imported beef, it's not sustainable for the U.S. cattle producer, because the reason why we don't have more animals right now is high cost of inputs, because of droughts, you know, fertilizer prices, diesel prices, corn prices are going up, all these high prices, cost of inputs. Well, they need a higher cattle price in order to be able to make money. And they can't just be making money. They have to be able to have enough that it will incentivize them to grow the herd. Because when they grow that herd, it's going to be a loss for a little bit. Well, if we at this time of year, particularly, which is when many producers are making that decision as to whether or not they're going to grow that herd, we put this massive volatility into the market that drops all these cattle prices down significantly. That's a nice short term from the consumer's perspective, right? Nice short term solution. However, we've just kind of stabbed ourselves in the foot here for a bit, because that decentivizes any growing of the herd, which means it's even further down the road before we can produce our own beef, enough beef for ourselves. So it creates a problem here that's a long-term problem.
And speaking of thinking in the long term, if I'm in the beef cattle business and I want to make a decision, it's not like I can have more cattle tomorrow, right? This is long-term planning going on. How does this kind of moving target, tariffs are going to change, but they're going to change for 3 months, and then who knows what's going to happen. How does that affect that farmer, that rancher's ability to plan for the future?
Well, and that's just it right now. You know, so you have a lot of these calves that are coming off pasture. So they've been on pastures with their mamas for this summer. And now as a cow-calf producer, I have to make a decision as to whether I'm going to keep this animal back for the year, right? In which case then next summer I can breed it, which means that it's there. So it's another, after next summer, it's still a year and a half at the earliest before that's going to produce beef, right? But that's the long term. Or do I just immediately put this into a feed yard right now to be able to get more animals? Well, that might be a short-term solution for more beef, but it's not a long-term solution for being able to supply the beef that we want in the United States. And we've created this volatility here. So for these producers, in kind of created a not accurate market price. So they're trying to make this long-term decision on by using economic data that isn't really representative of what this market situation should be.
Now, my limited understanding of economics says, okay, the price of beef has gone up, so consumers will say, gosh, that's too much. I'm going to put my money into other proteins that haven't gone up as much. Beef demand should go down. Is that how it works in real America?
Well, in real America, yes. So on a poundage-wise, you know, consumers might be looking at that, but we also have to look at it from the point of view of you know, that's a per capita, right? But the other thing is that we have really strong beef demand right now, and it's continuing to stay so. Because we can see that even though it's necessarily, okay, high prices, you'd think like, oh, well, should the demand drop by that same percentage? Not necessarily, because it doesn't necessarily, there's other components that go into it. And right now we can say that we have that strong demand because even with the high prices, we're maintaining the demand. People are not switching over necessarily to those other proteins. The increase in the price of beef that consumers are still buying it, relative to those other proteins, has gone up, but yet consumers are still buying that beef. So that tells me that U.S. consumers like this, our U.S. beef, you know, and that's a huge thing. We have imported more beef, you know, what we import versus what we export are not the same thing, because as we've talked about, we import lean beef trimmings, which we then turn around for the most part and use for hamburger, right? And we export our middle meats, you know, those whole muscle cuts, you know, as we bring more beef in, but that's what we consume a lot of. We like the whole muscle cuts. That brings a lot of value to the producers. That's what consumers are really willing to pay a lot for. But we also like our hamburger. We are a hamburger nation. We eat hamburgers. We cook hamburger at home. We just eat a lot of hamburger. And that's basically, this is attempting to bring it in to supplement kind of those, that part. But the unfortunate thing is that hamburger is a big percentage of that cattle. And if we hurt that price overall, that's going to bring down the entirety of the cattle price, which brings down any profitability for that cattle producer.
Brenda, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Brenda Botel is a professor and department chair of agricultural economics at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. Earlier, we heard from Brad Olson, president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau. We've been talking about President Trump's plan to allow some ground beef to be imported into the U.S. with tariff cuts.
Coming up, a new forest bathing trail near Eagle River will help people disconnect from their screens and reconnect with nature.
It's not really about hiking or necessarily getting somewhere. It's about just taking your time and engaging all your senses and being fully present with the natural world.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This summer, Wisconsin opened its first certified forest bathing trail.
Located just south of Eagle River, the quarter-mile Tara Lila Trail offers self-guided mindfulness activities. There are 51 trails of its kind around the globe.
These trails are designed to create a deeper connection with nature through slow, mindful movement. To become certified, sites have to go through a complex process and meet a list of 36 different criteria.
Holly Jo Walters is Program Director for the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy's Certified Forest Therapy Trails Program, and Cindy Conlin is a Certified Forest Therapy Guide and Trail Consultant in Eagle River. Cindy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Holly Jo, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Before we visit this trail in Eagle River, Holly Jo, introduce us, please, to this concept of forest bathing.
Forest, you know, a lot of folks kind of laugh or chuckle when they first hear the term forest bathing, because I think they're kind of imagining a bathtub in the woods. but it's nothing like that. It's a practice that began in Japan in the 80s. The government was really concerned about just stress and burnout and the health impacts of people spending less time in nature. And so as part of a broader public health initiative, they encourage people to slow down and spend, you know, intentional time in the forest. And so it's a little bit different. It's not, you know, it's not really about hiking or necessarily getting somewhere. It's about just taking your time and engaging all your senses and being fully present with the natural world. So.
And Holly Jo, what do we know about the health benefits of getting ourselves out in nature like this?
I mean, you know, I know I'm feeling a lot of stress just in the amount of time I spend in front of our screens these days. I'm pretty sure my heart rate's elevated, all those things. And what we know is just spending 20 minutes outside in nature has really big impacts actually on our bodies. So, I mean, we see lower cortisol levels, lower heart rates, and there's just so many really diseases and illnesses that are related to stress. So just taking a little bit of time, 20 minutes outside, is going to make a huge difference. And beyond that, you know, the trees gift us. We evolved with the trees, and they actually emit this amazing compound called a phytoncide. These have been studied for years now, but, you know, basically when a tree is getting attacked by a fungi or something that, you know, might impact the health of the tree, they release phytoncides to protect themselves. And we actually, our bodies actually respond to those phytoncides. So when we walk in the trees, we're actually breathing those in. And what happens is we see a big increase in a cell called the NK killer cell. It's a natural killer cell. And these cells like float throughout our bodies and like find free radicals and actually specifically target cancer cells. So just spending 3 hours out in the forest can have an impact for days. So there's just a lot of science behind it. But in addition to that, it feels good. I think anybody that spends a lot of time in nature and finds a solace out there understands what that feeling is. But there's definitely a lot of science behind it as well.
And Cindy, introduce us to this path in Eagle River, the trail, a Tara Leela Trail, a Tara Leela Trail. I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you. Richard and Amy Jo Aylward in 2007 wanted to create a place that people could enjoy nature silently. They actually, on their website, when talked about their mission, said the most satisfactory way to truly and deeply enjoy nature is to go quietly. So I found their land conservancy. It's about 10 minutes from downtown Eagle River. It's super accessible. And I started going there myself. Absolutely loved it. And then I became certified as a forest therapy guide through ANFT, Holly Jo's organization, and started leading forest bathing sessions there for people in Eagle River. So I was really attached to this property. And last January, after I read more about the certification process that Holly Jo is director of for ANFT, I emailed, just called the land manager and said, hey, I already use your trail. How about we become a certified forest bathing trail? And he emailed right back and said, I love everything about this idea. How do we do it? So I had to reach out to Holly Jo because I'm like, I actually don't know how you do it, but let's do it. And so we did.
We'll get into that certification in a minute, but Cindy, staying with you. Now, sometimes when I'm out walking in the woods in nature, I don't know, I'm going full speed, right? I'm covering a lot of ground, and that's fine. There's a healthiness to that, I think. What are you doing, though, when you're guiding people through forest bathing on a trail?
Well, you're providing, first of all, a curated space, which is partially what the certification is about. So this space is one that's going to naturally be quiet. It's going to meet many criteria, including having ideally dappled light. It's going to be accessible. It's not going to have any hazards. We don't have on my trail, I've checked, there's no poison ivy or logs. It's maintained so that when you're there, you're going to be safe. So that I think the first thing about being in this kind of experience is if you're going to calm your central nervous system, you have to feel comfortable, welcome, and safe. So we find a space that offers people that. And then secondly, I lead them through a series of invitations that help them connect with their senses. Again, we have an intention usually to get to the next task. And as you said, we're on to the next thing. When they're forest bathing, ideally, I as the guide can help them put their phone away, turn their watch into their pocket, and let go of time and really connect with all the senses to relate to the forest in a very deep and profound way.
Holly Jo, Cindy was just giving a couple of the basics there of what can make a trail, an appropriate place, a certifiable place for forest bathing. What does it take to find these trails and make sure, yeah, this is the right environment for this?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, the process, I think, seems rigorous because we look at a lot of different things. But the reality is every natural space is certifiable. So we're not coming in and saying yes or no.
The idea is to come in and actually curate the experience based on the landscape and the ecosystem that's there. So, you know, we have 51 trails across the world, and no two trails are alike. So every single trail is going to offer different elements. There's going to be a different type of sensory engagement that each trail is going to offer. And so, yeah, while we look at a number of factors around safety and, you know, safety on the trail, we look at the ecosystem health, we take in design considerations, and even how the space is managed. I often think these trails are also part of initiatives to really bring into focus the mission and values of the organizations that are engaging with us in this way. So we look at all of those things, but we're actually working with what's already existing in their landscape. And then how can we actually invite people into deeper relationship with it? So, you know, we might be creating additional spots for people to pause and just sit and actually take in, you know, whether it's visually or, you know, audibly, or even the smell or taste of the landscape. These things really have the ability to connect people in a way that just simply walking through without really that intention. I don't even want to say mindful, because the idea is to really drop out of our minds, right, and into our bodies and senses, so we
mindlessness.
Can
mindlessness. I can, yes, get into that.
No kidding, right? I think we all need a little bit more of that these days. But yeah, so. So it really is, you know, about each and every landscape and taking the time to be with each one and understand, you know, not just what we're feeling and seeing and experiencing, but what is the story of this landscape, you know, including the cultures and peoples maybe that came before it. And how are we, you know, how are we helping to connect people to this space?
We're talking about a new forest bathing trail in Wisconsin in Vilas County. Holly Jill Walters is with us from the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy, and Cindy Conlon, certified forest therapy guide and trail consultant in Eagle River. Cindy, just thinking about this, I got to say, I'm kind of chilling out a little bit. You get to observe people, right, on experiences like this. What do you see of the before, during, and after on how people's, I don't know, posture and bearing changes as they experience this?
Oh, it's always a transformation. It's great that you asked that question. It's my favorite part, is watching this happen. So people come and they're talking, and they're, you know, sometimes they're, you know, kind of walking really fast, and they're, you know, talking about how it took to get there and all of that. And then as we start connecting to their breath, and they put away their phone, you know, and there's research, by the way, that says that even having your phone out, if it's off, draws some of your attention, which is really scary. So I really encourage them to put it out of sight and even leave it in their car. I'll have a phone if there's an emergency. But I see them kind of just, they almost sigh. You can just see this physical letting go. And then as they get into the experience and they start doing things like, if they're comfortable, closing their eyes and starting noticing what they hear, their other senses become amplified. And we take about 70% of data in through our eyes. So when the eyes are allowed to go offline and we connect with these other senses where we have great ways of knowing, and they start really being present and their breathing slows down, they start walking slowly. And then at the end, when you ask them, what are they noticing? They notice themselves, things about the forest that they've never seen. Even when we walk by it, we do a point to point at Taralila. So when they come back, they're seeing a part they've already walked. But it is so common for them to say, I know I just saw this 30 minutes ago, but I didn't notice that tree right there in the middle of this area that's by itself. They absolutely see things in a completely new way. And they often say that they've never, well, I had one, we were laying on the ground looking at clouds. And I had a young man say, he was 20. He said, you know, I don't remember doing this. I know I did it when I was like 8 or 9, just being able to be present and look at what's around me. And he actually had tears in his eyes. And it was, that's not an uncommon reaction. People are so, they're restored and they're so grateful to just come back to themselves and know that nature helped them do it.
Holly Joe, we've got this one now in Wisconsin. There's, you mentioned, just over 50 around the world. Do you find that people get hooked on these? They become frequent foresters and want to start visiting more and more of these.
You know, I definitely see that happening. And the reality is people actually want more and more of the same places that they're going to. Mm. So each, you know, one of the ideas about visiting these trails is to continue to visit that trail throughout the seasons. Like, that landscape is constantly changing. It's constantly moving. So in order to really get into relationship with a place, right, we get to know it through all its seasons. People are like that too. So, I think, you know, it is inviting people not only into the idea of, wow, these trails exist, I want to see more of them, and they can see them in different ecosystems, different landscapes. Like I said, no two trails are the same. We have trails that don't even have trees. They have cacti, right? So it's a really great opportunity also as a destination for folks that are traveling and looking for ways to actually make an impact too on the ways that people travel. So really baked into the whole philosophy of this program is about reciprocity, because I mean, what we know is that people tend to care for the things they love. I think Jacques Cousteau actually said that. And it's beautiful, because once people come into relationship with a place, they're going to tend and care for that place in a different way. And I think that's really at the heart of all of this. So we're hoping people, yeah, continue to explore all these trails, but also continue to explore the ones that they've already been to on a continual basis. So, you know, and with that, I mean, we've got amazing guides like, you know, Cindy that are, you know, leading walks at these locations. So people can show up and have a self-guided walk where they're experiencing it on their own. And they have the opportunities to dive even deeper, because most forest therapy walks are going to take anywhere from, you know, an hour to 3 hours. And to just be guided in those spaces where you can just kind of like let go of everything and let your body sink into the place and know that someone's, you know, created a container in which you're held through that in such a beautiful way is really just a rejuvenating reset for our systems.
Yeah, and Cindy, my first thought of this would be it would be kind of a solitary activity, but is there a value in doing this forest bathing with a group of people?
Oh, I they're both great, but I really love the collective shared experience of it. So it's building community and it's getting people doing something, you know, off a screen, out of their house, where they're connecting with people that they might not have met. I've actually in Eagle River found this whole community of people that I started through forest bathing, and it's just been amazing. I think that shared experience is really valuable when you're asking people, what are you noticing? And if people want to share, they do. And what I always find is that what someone notices sparks something in me. It's like it brings it back a memory, or it connects me more deeply with that experience. It's just really powerful when it's done in a group.
Thanks for sharing this with us. And thanks, Cindy, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Holly Jo, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Holly Jo Walters is the program director for the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy's Certified Forest Therapy Trails Program. And Cindy Conlon is a certified forest therapy guide and trail consultant in Eagle River. Been talking about the new forest bathing trail near Eagle River.
Yesterday on the show, we learned about the community of rock hounders in Wisconsin who collect cool rocks and create collections from these gemstones and minerals.
We heard from Emily in Manitowoc, who's a big rock hounder with her fiancé Turner. Emily writes, "We live on Lake Michigan, so there are many good spots around us."
Emily goes on to say that they built a very large rock tumbler in the basement of their apartment and started a business this year focused on the process of rock tumbling and making polished stones.
Thanks for writing, Emily. You could share your rock hounding excursions and discoveries. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Trevor Hook, and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.